It turns out that when I make moral claims, I'm not talking about my preferences. I'm actually making a claim about the nature of reality. I think it helps to appeal to example because people live in the real world. And so when we give them examples of what they would encounter in their day-to-day and show them, I'm going to encounter that there's an objective reality that I run into. And sometimes it works with my preferences and many times it does not.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
Welcome to the Thinking Matters podcast, where we explore the intersection of faith and reason and culture and a lot of other topics which just tend to pop up. I'm your host, Todd Funk, and today I'm really excited to be joined by a remarkable couple from Colorado. They're coming to New Zealand this January to do our youth and young adults apologetics / worldview camp in Ngāruawāhia. Trip and Megan Almond, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us. We are excited to join you right now, but especially excited to join the Thinking Matters camp in January.
Well, that's cool. Have either of you been to New Zealand? Megan, I'm thinking that you have.
I have back in 2018, and I did a series of youth conferences there.
With Jason,
it was only on the
right?
North Island, though.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I think I sat down and had a meal with you and Rodney and Jason then. So, okay. And when you guys are coming, are you budgeting in a little bit of time for any holiday spots, seeing, you know, Hobbiton or anything else?
A little bit. We'll have some afternoons free. We'll have the weekend in between the two camps free. There's the one on the North Island and South Island. And then at the end, we have a 2 or 3 days where we'll play on the South Island.
Good.
Which is great because we're bringing our kids. We're planning just to have the best time. Mm-hmm.
That's just awesome. Wow. Does your boy skateboard? Because I got some skateboards I can bring along, and there's some places down there to skateboard in Ngāruawāhia.
I'm not sure he's met something with wheels that he cannot do.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll see if I can organize that.
He's been riding a bike all of his life. Well, he learned to walk using a Strider bicycle, a walking bicycle. So I like to say he was riding a bike before he walked.
I got it.
He's on a bicycle most of the time.
Yeah. He got the balancing genes from you. I Googled you a bit. You did gymnastics, didn't you?
We'll claim that.
Both of us were gymnasts, and we met while we were each coaching gymnastics. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you guys went to university and did gymnastics through university?
That's right.
Megan did. I stopped competing. My second year into university, I was competing with a club program, not for a school. And then I was coaching when we met at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia, here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I did a little bit of, not gymnastics, but I did pole vault, which kind of has a little bit of, you know, inversion. And anyway.
Extremely technical.
Yeah. Well, I was just kind of the daredevil type and I couldn't high jump or do anything else, but I wanted to do track and field. So yeah, just there we go. Well, let me tell our audience, listening audience and viewing audience a little bit about each of you before we jump in so they'll get some background. So Trip, according to the internet, you serve as kind of a speaker and teacher with Summit Ministries. And you help equip youth and young adults with kind of a strong biblical worldview and help them to engage with truth and morality and culture. And then Megan, you're a pro-life apologist and writer with Life Training Institute. You speak widely throughout the U.S. and obviously beyond on bioethics and the value of human life and communicating truth with compassion. Anything else we need to know? I just found out, you know, you've got two children, a 19-year-old, 13-year-old.
Yeah, well, the two of us actually are now working with Stand to Reason, and that's a recent development.
Cool.
Trip ran the Gap Year program at Summit Ministries for 7 years, so our whole family was involved with that, loved it.
What's the Gap Year Ministries? I don't think I've heard of that.
Great question.
You've mentioned it twice now.
Yeah, so it is really a first year of college. It's meant to be for students coming out of high school before they go to university. So they are learning then to really know what they believe and why they believe it, to own their faith, mm-hmm. not just, you know, and they've inherited their mom and dad's faith usually. So it's time for them to really start asking those questions if they haven't, but also to begin learning to live independently And of course, we live in the mountains of Colorado. And so it gives them an opportunity to explore and learn and through nature. So these things coming together, we call it a head, heart, hands kind of education, really forms these students to prepare them to get the most out of university and to be a good ambassador for Christ while they're on university campus.
That's cool. And is it a year? Is it 9 months? Sorry, Megan.
It is. It's, yeah, 3 months in the fall, 3 months in the spring.
Yeah, I think a gap year as a concept has been around for a while. It's a growing trend in the States, but now there are many more structured gap year programs like the one that Summit still has. But Tripp recently accepted a full-time position with Stand to Reason, running what they call their outposts, which are really, you do a better job of this than me, but small groups in local churches who utilize the apologetics training of Stand to Reason to help equip their churches to be better able to make a case for their faith wherever they find themselves.
That's right. That's right. So my job is to onboard and support those outpost directors around the world. We've got one in New Zealand right now, but
really, who's the one in New Zealand? I'll just give a shout out.
Her name is Becky, and she's in South Island. Wyndham, I think, is the name of the. Yeah, I'd have to look at her last name. I forgot.
And that's for that local community, right? I mean, up in the North Island, that doesn't do us much good. So when you're here, you're going to recruit some more.
Yes.
Our thought is that the primary discipleship arena really ought to be the local church. And so this is a way for us, Stand to Reason, to come alongside the local church and give support to them. So we're still involved with Summit Ministries. We're still on faculty with them, but I'm not running a program there. I work for Stand to Reason. And when I came over to Stand to Reason, well, it only made sense because Megan and I love to work together, speak together, that she came on board with Stand to Reason as well. Mm-hmm. They've kind of been after her for a while. Anyway.
Oh, well, it's a small world. I've been friends with the team at Stand to Reason for years, so it was a natural step to join them.
And though Megan started off speaking primarily, you know, with pro-life apologetics, she speaks on such a wide variety of topics. It made a lot more sense, just career-wise, topic-wise, right, for us both to be on board with Stand to Reason.
Cool. Listen, you know, I'm expecting great things. Oh, that's neat.
No pressure.
All right, no pressure. Well, tell me a little bit about each of you individually, your spiritual journey. How did you come to Christ, or were you kind of born into the Christian faith and everything?
I often say that I was born into Christianity. I was born a Christian. I had lots of questions, however, 11th or 12th grade. So we're talking, 17, 18 years old. My first question, really big question for myself was, why am I even a Christian? And I realized I was a Christian because I didn't know any better. Like, it was just default.
Right.
I think that was probably the age where I started paying attention. So I started seeing some hypocrisy of what was being taught through my Christian community and what was being lived out. And I thought it looked a little bit in contradiction. But I also had conflicts with what I was learning in biology class at school and what I was learning in Sunday school. Mm-hmm. I knew that we worship this good God that was all powerful, but I was also seeing the incredible evil and suffering that was in the world. One of my best friends growing up died of bone cancer in the 11th grade. And this just, none of this seemed to go together. So I started asking questions. I did what I thought I was supposed to do. I started asking questions. Unfortunately, the response that I sometimes got directly and more so just kind of caught is that I didn't have enough faith. And I wasn't really sure what people meant by that when they said, Tripp, you need to have more faith. But I tried to have more faith. What I thought that meant at the time was compartmentalize, stuff my questions, ignore my doubts, and just pretend, go through the motions, and eventually my questions would disappear.
Wow, well, that's really good. So many young people are right there, aren't they? Just their parents, their youth group are telling them, just have more faith, trust God. And you're in cognitive dissonance if you're a thinker at all, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. And looking back, I think they just didn't know how to answer, or they were nervous of those questions themselves. And Well, it was, I left my little Christian bubble that I grew up in, where I was pressured to think and act and talk and believe a certain way, and stepped onto university campus. And my questions were not helped,
well, at least
not positively, right?
Yeah.
By God's grace, this is the way I typically put it, is that I stumbled into this realm of study called Christian apologetics, which I had never heard of. I learned that Christians, at least some Christians, think. And that was surprising to me. And they do so really, really well. Long story short, I became convinced that Christianity was actually true. I had never even thought about it that way before. I mean, it was my faith growing up, but that it's true, like it's an accurate representation of the way the world really is. I fought a little bitterness and resentment towards the church until I realized, wait, I am the church.
You are the church. Yeah. You can't hate the church, or you're hating yourself.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So it became something of my mission in life to create environments where students could ask questions and pursue the answers to those questions. If Christianity is true, then it can stand up to our toughest questions, to the doubts that we have. We don't have to be scared. All truth is going to lead us to the source of truth, which ultimately rests in a person whose name is Jesus. Mm-hmm. And from what I was doing at the time, coaching, to then pastoring, to then leading a gap year and doing student ministry with Summit Ministries, to what I'm doing now with Stand to Reason, that has been in the backdrop the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, I can hear some of your topics that you're going to do in January being woven through your testimony of things that you were, you know, wrestling with. How cool is that? And, you know, you've lived that out. So you have that to share as a personal experience. But what about you, Megan? How did you come to know the Lord? What's your little journey?
Yeah. I grew up in a home that was at least nominally Christian. So I was very much in that culture. And I remember learning as a small child how to pray. I remember my grandmother being a significant person in my life who walked out the faith in front of me. And I was motivated to be a good girl. I was a firstborn. So I was going to be a rule follower. I was going to do it all perfectly. Right.
Gosh.
So I think that Jesus became my savior a while before he became my Lord. And that's the best way I know how to describe what happened in my life. I grew up in the sport of gymnastics, did that into college, as we've already talked about, but I was 19 years old before I understood for the first time that this faith, like Tripp said, that was my faith, actually applied to all these different areas in my life. And so I felt like a toddler learning to walk in college as a young adult. This is right around the time I met Tripp, and he had kind of answered or was beginning to answer some of these questions for himself. So the questions that he struggled with when it came to discovering Christian apologetics were not my questions. If anything, my interests were more in the areas of art and storytelling. So I was interested in people. I wanted to draw human subjects. I wanted to write human stories. And I was actually working as a newspaper reporter after we were married, and I went to cover a local pregnancy resource center banquet one night for my community newspaper. I was actually not supposed to go to that event. The Lord had different plans. The girl who was supposed to go went on a date. And so the editor sent me and Scott Klusendorf, who is the president and founder of Life Training Institute, was the speaker that night, and he spoke on pro-life apologetics. That was not my introduction into apologetics, but it was my introduction into seeing that the truth was very, very beautiful, and that I could talk about human dignity and human value, and I could learn to tell the stories about what it means to be human. And because it connected so deeply with the issue of abortion, which is an issue that is huge in the States, and I know it's an issue that's big in New Zealand as well. I was there in 2018 when the laws changed in New Zealand. That was something that I had to start talking about. And so Scott took me under his wing and trained me as a speaker. And from there, I think my questions have continued into adjacent areas. But they all come back to those two things. What does it mean to be human? And what is this thing that we call beauty? Is it real? And does it matter? So a lot of what I like to talk about intersects there.
Yeah. And it sounds like you were born for such a time as this in this culture, because storytelling and, you know, the human element of everything is just front and center, isn't it? And
all, yes,
and
it
all
is.
We do. Yeah. And it sounds like, I mean, God has woven your skill sets into a perfect match for what you guys are doing right now. You know,
it sure seems that way. Look, it's so wild to look back over the course of our lives and see this thread that has been woven together. It really, it can only be attributed to the Lord, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're going to talk about, you know, finding your purpose and whatnot, you know, how to hear God's voice. But I don't know, for me, I don't know about your journey, but it just kind of seems like you look back on it. I'm 63. I look back and say, wow, God has woven a perfect tapestry. What I'm doing now, it's very discrepant. I do Bible in school, you know, kids programs. I do kids camps. I do obviously apologetics and speaking. And it's just a very disparate mix, but it works. And I really am fulfilled in what I'm doing. I said, God, I see your hand in it. Now, I just was being faithful one step at a time, walking it out, being faithful, and God does the rest. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let's get into and tease out a few of the talks that you're going to do and just pull out a few things. So Megan, your first session is on relativism, and a lot of teens today and young adults, you know, their slogan, that's true for you, but not for me, or everyone has their version of the truth. And I mean, that sounds so appealing, but you know, how do we lovingly challenge that?
Well, I think that it actually comes from a good place. I think that the rising generation, and mine as well, nobody wants to be seen as offensive or worse, arrogant.
Yeah, that's the cardinal sin, isn't it?
Right? Mm-hmm. We're really good at those softer virtues, right? Kindness and compassion and all of that. Yes. And those are important. But we also need courage and tenacity and some of those others. So back to that whole point about not wanting to be seen as arrogant. I think anytime that we claim to have the truth, that sounds very arrogant to a culture that has adopted moral relativism, which is that notion that, you know, there's no real good or no real morality that we can know objectively in the world that exists apart from us. Rather, it's something that I either create for myself or the culture creates. That's what makes things right or wrong.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that the difference between what is subjective and objective comes into play. And it's pretty clear to see the difference between subjective and objective truths when you make a silly statement like, oh, it's true that my favorite flavor of ice cream is, you know, fill in the blank. Week, I would imagine that it's something like salted peanut butter cup, right? It changes for me. but that's my truth. So that's a subjective thing. And not everybody would agree that that's true. They'd say, oh, well, that's your truth. And that's appropriate. But it'd be different for me to make a different kind of statement like, oh, well, that salted peanut butter cup ice cream, that's the cure for type 1 diabetes. Well, now we're talking about something entirely different. That truth isn't made true by me preferring it or even believing it. There's something different about it. I made an objective kind of claim on that second one, something that deals with things that stand or fall apart from me and what I create and my preferences. So it turns out that when I make moral claims, I'm not talking about my preferences. Mm-hmm. I'm actually making a claim about the nature of reality. So just like that second claim that I made about the ice cream, that it's the cure for juvenile diabetes, well, that either accurately describes the way that that works in reality or it doesn't, apart from me. Similarly, when I make moral claims, it's not about me. It's about the way the world really is, and it either accurately describes it or not. They're objective kinds of claims. And it turns out that when I make an objective claim about morality and say that I think that I'm right, it's the farthest thing from being arrogant there can be. Now, I could be arrogant with my tone. I could be arrogant with my attitude. But the claim itself, by its very nature, can be true or false. It can be right or wrong. It's actually humble ground to stand on.
Yeah. Are young people responsive to that, Megan? I mean, we're such a post kind of modern world. Does the truth still persuade or do you need to appeal to story and beauty and these things?
I think it helps to appeal to example because people live in the real world And so when we give them examples of what they would encounter in their day to day and show them, maybe even through story, but certainly through the narrative of my day, right? I'm going to encounter that there's an objective reality that I run into. And sometimes it works with my preferences and many times it does not.
Does that lead naturally into Tripp's talk after that? He's talking about, you know, does God exist? And that's an objective truth claim, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. It does lead directly into that because in the same way this applies to moral sorts of claims, this applies to religious claims as well. Those like God exists. This is not a preference type of claim. Either God exists or God does not exist. It's one or the other. No matter what I believe, I don't make God exist by believing it. I don't make God not exist by not believing it. And this is something that we can evaluate. We can ask, and we don't have to be scared of asking, does God even exist? You know, is all this just a myth, a story that's made up, or is this a true story of reality? And I actually think that we can come to the reasonable conclusion that God does exist. And we don't have to go to priests or the Bible or to religious authorities to, just have faith. as sometimes the saying goes, like, just close your eyes and wish for it to be true.
Yeah.
That's a way.
What kind of evidences are you going to bring up in that talk?
Yeah. Yeah. So in our time together, we're going to just reflect on the universe and the fact that we are here. And because we are here, because the universe exists, time, space, energy, and matter, we are going to follow a train of thinking of our asking some questions. Has the universe always been here, or did it have a beginning? We can look at philosophical and scientific evidence to see that, well, the universe actually had a beginning. That's the most reasonable conclusion. Well, if it had a beginning, was that beginning, was it caused or uncaused? We'll explore that. And then I think that it was caused, but I'll share why, right? And then if it's caused, what caused it? Was the cause, spawning from some other event? Or was there a mind involved in this creation? It turns out that the only reasonable conclusion is that a mind, a being, an agent that is independent from this universe, time, space, energy, and matter, that has to be really powerful and really intelligent, had to begin it all. I think this is overwhelming evidence that there must be a God that exists.
You'll take them to deism or theism. In other words, there's some kind of God. Right. He doesn't care about us, or there is a God and he has communicated with us and he's still interactive with us. I mean, how far do you get us with that?
That's right. I think we can get all the way to theism, and we can get, I think, to some characteristics of this God that exists. For example, some of those that I mentioned: intelligent, creative,
powerful,
but we can only go so far. I think this demonstrates very clearly to us that a God must exist. And then we go on then to ask the question, well, what exactly is this God like? There are some huge questions that we have that we could not just discover in virtue of being creatures living in this creation. I think we can come to that conclusion that God exists in that way. But the biggest questions that we have, we would need this God, this creator, to actually give us some insight, some revelation, which theologians refer to as special revelation. God needs to communicate to us in a particular or special way to get our questions answered. Like,
right.
Why are we here? Why is there evil in the world? Is there life after death?
Yeah.
The big things that we ask.
And again, I'm just as bright as I am. I'm just now seeing the brilliance of the logic of your talks. Megan, you jump in with your bear argument. I've never heard of the bear. I've heard of mama bear apologetics and the roar, but the bear about the resurrection. What's that all about? Give me the B-E-A-R.
Right. When this moves us from some theistic kind of worldview to a a particular theistic worldview, which
why
would be
should we consider
Christianity. Yeah. Right.
Christianity. And I've had that question asked to me before. And I just simply go to the same place Paul did in 1 Corinthians 15, where he staked all of it on this historical event. If Jesus rose from the dead, it changes everything. Yeah. But if he didn't rise from the dead, apparently the Corinthians were really struggling with that question, then we are of all people most to be pitied. We are still in our sins. And so Christianity, first and foremost, as we're seeing, as Tripp's talking about multiple evidences that we can explore, Christianity is testable. There are evidences, and we're even invited. Paul in his letter invites the Corinthians. Don't take my word for it. Go ask the others who experienced seeing him, talking with him after he rose from the dead. The BEAR is an acronym, a helpful acronym, and we will walk through every single step of it. We're going to use just a handful of those evidences, pieces of evidence, so that we can form an argument that lets us know that the resurrection is the best explanation of what happened that day in history. And I'll run you through what BEAR stands for, but I will unpack it at the conference.
Okay.
B is...
just a bullet point, yeah.
That's right. B is the burial of Jesus, which implies that he died. We'll talk all about that and why we have good reason to believe it happened exactly as it was written in the gospel accounts. And even some extra biblical authorities talked about that as well. The empty tomb discovered by women on the third day, the appearances of Jesus after his resurrection, and then the rise of Christianity. That has to be explained. Something happened
that caused
Christianity to spread like wildfire. And that's just a handful of the pieces of evidence we have surrounding the resurrection. There are hundreds of lines of reasoning that you could take, but I want to demonstrate that with just those four, we can actually conclude that the resurrection is a better explanation than any other story that's ever been offered.
That's great. I do a lot of talks with young people, but one of them is about the resurrection, and I cover those. But I'm telling you now, I'm going to steal that. I hope you don't mind.
Do it. That's what I tell the audience. Like, once it's out there, this is yours.
Go
it's
for
meant
it.
To be used.
That's the way I'm with all my talks. When somebody asked me for a talk, I said, here's the PowerPoint too. Let there be two of me. Let there be three
right.
of me.
Yes. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, that's great. And then, Tripp, you jump after that with Jesus the only way. How arrogant is that? I mean, you've touched on it a little bit, but how do we profess that without coming across as being arrogant?
Yeah, really good. Because when we make this claim, Jesus is the only way to heaven. Oh, come on, you Christian! You're so narrow-minded, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
you've grown up in this little echo chamber, and now you think that you're the good guys and everybody else is the bad guys. You're going to heaven. Everybody else is going to hell just because you were born into it. This doesn't seem fair. So these are the questions surrounding this claim that we're going to look at, because this exclusive claim is not just a claim that Christians make. It actually came from the lips of Jesus when he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're going to do is, as we explore those questions,
what I love about this talk, when you do it, is that it's very much done with narrative, mm-hmm. because he revisits the story of reality.
That's mm-hmm. So that's exactly what we will do. I think that these questions... when they're divorced from the understanding of the biblical meta-narrative, this overarching story of the Bible, we can have these questions. But when we just take a step back and review this major story, and I just walk students through the major acts of the story, creation, fall, redemption, restoration, we see that this claim, I am the only way, that Jesus made, is actually a really, really good news. Mm-hmm. The fact that there is a way that we don't deserve to be saved, that we are sinful, we've rebelled against God, we've contributed to evil. And isn't that's another complaint, right? That mm-hmm. you Christians worship this God, but there's so much evil.
The way that the story unfolds, really, the talk unfolds in this way too. The questions end up answering themselves.
So after we look at this meta-narrative, right? This idea that God must get rid of evil, except there's a problem, because can you really separate evil from evildoers? God demonstrates his not just his justice, but also his mercy as this story unfolds. And so I invite then the students to look back through those challenges, those questions in light of that meta-narrative, and we work through answering them together. Mm-hmm. You know, is this narrow-minded? Well, it's narrow, but that's different than being narrow-minded. It's not arrogant if we think that we're right. We want to make sure we don't have an arrogant attitude, but if we think that we're right, well, we could be wrong. And we'll see that this that's claim that. Is really good news, and it's actually very, very inclusive. And Christianity is one of the most inclusive religions there is, because you don't actually have to do anything. Jesus has done it all. You simply have to get
it. It's found in every culture, every tribe on the earth, you know? So, yeah. And I'll have access to all the talks. I'll listen to them afterwards. I've done that camp the last couple of years, and they decided, no, they've seen and heard enough of you. And I tend to agree.
We all get our turns.
Yeah. No, we're excited to have you. We really are. And I'll be doing 2 weeks consecutive of kids camps in a place that's about an hour from there. So I might pop in on the Wednesday, because that's their pool day anyway. So you might see me there. I'd be there on the Wednesday. Yeah. That'd be good. So the talks tend to take a bit of a break. Megan, you're going to talk about addressing, you know, making the case for life. Mm-hmm. And what's the goal of that? To motivate them to be pro-life activists, or to kind of just rethink all the issues at hand, have a reasonable answer to the pro-choice rhetoric? Or what do you hope them to get out of
that? Yeah, I'm going to say yes in answer to
that. Yes.
Okay. I hope that it moves everybody a little bit further down the road from where they stand on their current view. If they're already pro-life, I hope this will equip them to have great conversations about the issue with their friends that are actually amicable conversations and encouraging conversations. I hope that those who are kind of never really thought about the issue before or don't really know where they stand on the issue are challenged in such a way that they might consider the pro-life view. And I hope that those who hold an abortion advocacy view, those who are for abortion, might be challenged just to think about it differently. It's not a talk that comes with condemnation or judgment. It's a talk that comes with reasons, and it is gospel-centered. And so we are going to really address the questions, what does it mean to be human and valuable, which are the undercurrents of any conversation about an issue like abortion, which is very related to other injustices that we face. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a theme that underrides the abortion question, and or an assumption rather, that I want to bring to light. And it's the assumption that if I'm right with the evidence that I bring, that those who would advocate for abortion are really believing the idea that some human beings simply don't matter as much as other human beings. Mm-hmm. That is something that you can relate to a number of other injustices, because that's an idea that's not new. It's been around for a long time, and it's been manifested throughout history and in other instances today. We'll make a scientific case for the humanity of the unborn, and then we'll go to philosophy to ground human value as something that is intrinsic, that is part of our human nature. Theologically, we can ground that all the way to bedrock with the Imago Dei. But intrinsic rather than based on our functions or our abilities.
That's good. I'm going to do a Halloween alternative talk tomorrow night here. And, have you seen the dollar bill demonstration where, you take a bill and you deface it? No value, worthless. Did that change the value? And then drag it through the mud and stomp on it and everything. And that's the way humans tend to, you know, think life sometimes, but it does not change the value of it at all. I love that. So you're going to, I don't know, are you both going to talk about marriage and sexuality when it comes? Is that a joint session or?
Is that... I normally let Megan handle that one. We end up doing one a little later in the week that will kind of trade off of the content they learned there on just dating and relationships, friendships, but also dating relationships. And that's usually a popular one with.
Well, I imagine, the age group that you're doing, they're always wanting to.
Yeah, the approach of that talk isn't the title can throw you. It's not how to have a great marriage, though it can help with how to have a great marriage. I think when we start to get down into evidences of, is marriage something that exists in reality? Is it something real, or is it something that we just created as a society? Because if we created it as a society, it can be changed. But if it's something that exists that's real, our good friend John Stone Street of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview would say, is marriage like gravity? Is it something that's already existing as part of the way the world really is? Or is it something that we created? And then we'll talk about that from a, more of a historical and sociological standpoint. And then, of course, sex and sexuality with it, because the two go hand in hand. What is it and what is it for? So we're going to be reasoning through these questions about two things, marriage and sexuality, that even though I talk about the issue of abortion regularly, I think that the topic of marriage and sexuality is one that brings to the surface more pain that has been caused by people's experiences of these things in a world that's very broken than any other topic. So I want us to see them for what they really are. I want us to get down to the original design. And if we can just glimpse the beauty of what God created, both in sex as it exists within marriage and in marriage, is something worth fighting for.
So that the topic then of making the case for life combined with how she does marriage and sexuality really gives us and the students, therefore, a framework to talk about all the major cultural issues that are going on today dealing with identity and sexuality, but helping the students to see a good and beautiful picture so that we might be able to address those counterfeits.
So it sounds like you're purposely going to build in enough biblical anthropology and into the talks beforehand, before these hot topics get pushed, that you'll be able to relate to them. You'll be able to build on the foundation you built on humanity.
We hope so. Yeah, the team at Thinking Matters has really been wonderful in aiding us and letting us craft this way. And
I think
of course,
it's great.
We believe the Holy Spirit's involved in all of it. So,
yeah. How often do you guys team teach like this for 3 days? Looks like you're going to be here for 3 days.
Yeah. Well,
as often as we are invited to.
Right. We love speaking together, and we know how helpful it is because we've run programs ourselves and, tried to structure speakers and there's something really important about the flow and tying each one, to the next. And that takes a good bit of work when you have speakers coming from, various places. And
of course,
it makes it so much easier when it's, Megan and I together, because we know what each other is going to be saying and we can work really closely together to craft this overarching narrative or topics for the students.
It all goes together.
Yeah.
And so it helps, like you said, to build a foundation for things that we can draw back upon and pull and make connections for students, or perhaps they better can make connections themselves.
Yeah. This gives us a really fun time then with the students as we get to just hang out with them in conversation during the day and the more formal Q&A times.
Yeah. I'm a firm advocate of camp type settings where you're with them for a while and Q&As and personal, with that. So, I mean, when they get to, they're so much getting in their heads and their minds through social media, through everything that you create your own reality. You decide your own gender and your own sexuality and love is love and God created us this way. Where do you gently come with that because I'm sure you'll get that a lot.
Just with that question. Well, part of it, if we've laid the foundation for what it means to be human, which this isn't built in here yet, but it probably will come out in Q&A, what is meant by the Imago Dei language? Now, I'm not claiming to have figured that out altogether. There have been thousands of years of prior to me. But we've gleaned some knowledge that we can begin to understand that what it means to be human is a whole lot more than one aspect of what we do as human beings, or an aspect of what we are as human beings, which is our sex. And so when we want to take that word sex and divorce it from those questions that I plan to address, what is it and what is it for? Those are the questions not many people are asking. In fact, our friend Sean McDowell.
You're talking about sex, sexuality, not gender.
Right. Okay. Well, I wouldn't make a differentiation between those two things, though I know many do. And that's something, in conversation, you have to work out when you have people define their terms. But the problem is, if we take sex and we do what the culture has done with it, which is to make it a god, right? Something that we worship, that we assume.
It's the all-encompassing, isn't it?
Yes, only for the sake of pleasure. Well, we've reduced sex in a way to mean less than it was meant to be, to mean less than it was meant to mean. Sex, after all, we are sexed beings. So I should be able to talk about that word as a woman without ever talking about the act of intimacy that happens between a man and wife. Everything I do is as a sexed being. I pray, I sleep, I wake, I eat, I serve as a sexed being, a woman. So when we make it God, we reduce what sex is. When we take ourselves and say that all that we are is our sex, our orientation, our sexual preferences, well, then we've reduced ourselves to be less than what we were meant to be as human beings. Either way, there's an error there. And I would hope that in a conversation, in drawing this out, drawing these ideas out, we wouldn't be belittling anything, but rather showing that there's so much more to behold. That the truth of the way God designed us and designed the world and designed the sex act is actually far more beautiful than anything that we could have dreamt up ourselves or that we think we understand. And it points to heavenly realities. There's a lot there, but the long and short of it is to take what the culture has reduced and demonstrate that the Christian story gives us so much.
Paint a better picture, give a better story. I love it. I love it. And Tripp, you're going to talk about, you know, God and good God and why evil. And that was important to you as in your journey as a young Christian.
Very much so.
And where are you going to take that talk? I love that talk. I do one myself.
It's so important. It seems to be this very, at least rhetorically, powerful argument against Christianity, right? If God is all good and he's all powerful, then it seems like he should be able to prevent evil. And it seems like he should want to prevent evil, but look at all the evil in the world. So it's obvious that God doesn't exist, or at least not that Christian version of God.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the major things I want to help students see is that though this, seems at first maybe like a huge problem for the Christian, this is a problem for everyone who lives in this reality where evil exists. Every worldview has to account for it in some way. Now, it turns out that there are some worldviews that cannot account for it at all. Like an atheistic worldview, any sort of materialistic worldview, there's no grounds on which to legitimately complain about a problem of evil. You could complain about things that you don't like, but if there is objective evil, then that means there is a way that the world is supposed to be and it's messed up. Well, the only way there's a way that the world is supposed to be is if there is a supposer. So the problem of evil.
Our friend Greg, the founder of Stand to Reason, often uses that line.
Yeah.
Well, the problem of evil is actually good evidence for a God of some sort. And the Christian story of reality, I think, gives the best explanation as to why there is evil. But we'll end up addressing the problem of evil on a head, heart, and hands level. So we want to address it intellectually to see that this argument, this official argument, doesn't stand up. But when people complain about the problem of evil, it's usually, although intellectual language is used, it's normally not a purely intellectual problem. In the same way that it was for me, I couched it in intellectual language, like I laid out that argument. But really what I wanted to know is, why did my friend die? Why did he waste away in a hospital bed like he did? And I want to maybe just walk with the students through this heart kind of posture when it comes to the challenge. We can't exactly know the mind of God and answer the questions, why does God allow every particular kind of thing to happen?
Yeah.
But we can know that God is with us and along with us actually hates evil, and he is doing something about it. And that's where we get to the hands part of the talk, where God is doing something about evil. It won't be around forever. He invites us to limit the evil in the world. And we'll talk about some things that we can do. And we can anticipate the return of Christ, where all evil will be dealt with. But the Lord's not coming back yet, because not because he's slow to fulfill his promise, but he's patient. He's not finished saving people. And this is a demonstration of God's love, actually.
Yeah. So that's well, and then that God has experienced evil himself, hasn't he, in the that's cross?
Right. That's right. Yeah. Atrocity. He doesn't sit by and watch us suffer. He entered into it himself to know what we go through. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've mentioned, you know, Greg Kokel and whatnot several times. You're going to do a talk, Megan, on tactics. I assume that's after the book, going through that. And what are you kind of the key takeaway or takeaways you want the students to go away with that?
Well, I want the students to walk away understanding that in conversations about their faith, first of all, they come from a position of great strength, not weakness. There are excellent reasons to believe that Christianity is really true. So we don't have to feel threatened or afraid when other people disagree with us or want to challenge us. But the other thing that I want them to walk away understanding is that questions are their best friend. And in that session in particular, we'll learn to ask three different types of questions that help us navigate conversations with more confidence. We'll ask questions that seek to gain information. I'll teach them a particular kind of question that does that and how we would use that and why we would use it. A question that gathers reasons for the other person's view so that you might understand what they believe and why they believe it. And then even the opportunity to offer some information with these students, they're going to learn a lot at Thinking Matters Camp that they may want to offer to their friends. You can actually offer those things in the form of a question so that it can be very non-threatening and you can receive feedback from the person you're talking to. Now, asking questions is one thing, and I want them to hone those skills, but I also hope what comes through is that their character matters. And when we ask questions, we want to really listen. That when we really listen, we want to interact with the person and not just the question. So many things come through that session, but it's a highly practical one, which is why it's toward the end of the time at camp.
Right. And also towards the end, Tripp, you're doing a talk on God's will and decision-making, and I kind of alluded to that earlier. I grew up kind of with a charismatic Pentecostal background, and all you got to do is just focus on God and pray more and listen to the Holy Spirit. And boy, for not just young people that are hormonal and is this the one for me? Is this the person for me? But even us old people, it's just very confusing and then trying to hear the voice of God. So what are you going to advocate for the young
people? Yeah, good. So This is one of my favorite topics, and in large part because it brought me so much distress. I thought that
the question, not the
Well,
not the talk.
Trying to be able to make decisions because I wanted to make decisions that were aligned with what God wanted me to make. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't help when you get people saying, "Oh, God told me," and God says this, and you're like, really? That must be nice.
I thought every Christian was hearing an audible voice from God, and therefore I'm a bad Christian because I'm not having all of the, and as I started, you know, asking more questions, well, when they said God told me, they usually didn't mean they had an audible voice. Rather, they had these impressions or feelings.
Right.
And I certainly didn't know how to interpret those signs in the universe that God was trying to give me, but because I was kind of adopting a paradigm that has arisen within the last 150 years. In Christian circles, not just here in America, but around the world, that trades on this idea that like God has made a very specific decision for you, and you have to jump through all the right hoops to figure out what that decision is so that you can make it. And if you're a good Christian, then you'll be able to decipher what he's trying to tell you. And So I was extremely.
I'm getting triggered as you say that, man.
Yeah, right.
That's what it was. It's like radio waves. They're everywhere. God wants to speak. You just have to tune in. What living heavenly
right.
Father wouldn't want to talk to you daily?
Yeah, that's right.
And well, my favorite part of this talk is that the way that he answers that question about how do we hear God's voice, how do we make godly decisions, is he just walks through the scripture.
We look at God's will. Like, what is God's will? There's two distinctions we can make in the types of God's will, God's sovereign will or God's will of desire. Mm-hmm. And long story short, God's will for our lives is more about who we are than what we do. And I think that.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well,
good. What do you mean by that?
That is what we're going to unpack. So God desires some things of us, but it involves our relationship with Him, and it involves our character. And as we become more sanctified, then we are more capable of making godly decisions. Decisions are hard work, but we don't have to be paralyzed waiting for God to tell us every decision that we should make to know what to do. It seems like a loving father would communicate his will to us clearly, plainly, maybe even put it in a place where we could easily find it. I think he has in scripture. And actually, you know, looking back, so many people are looking for personal experiences with God, which should be expected because we're in a personal relationship. But what I had allowed, and I think what many of us are allowing, is a new spirituality to creep into our Christian worldview that says God is kind of like a force that I'm disconnected from, and I have to jump through hoops or manipulate to get information from Him to know what to do next. And it turns out God is so much more intertwined with us than that. The Christian worldview is not that we go to God, but God has already come to us. And this loving Father wants to help us grow, become sanctified, to make godly decisions, not to tell us every decision to make. So I want to release students to make godly decisions confidently. And I think I will give them a good biblical formula for doing exactly that.
Well, good. Certainly young Christian people need that. I'm looking forward to hearing that if I'm there on the day. We'll see. So you guys are going to wind up, it seems like, with the Q&A session and then, you know, dating relationships. We've talked about that a bit, and then kind of a talk by one or both of you on what's stopping you. And what do you ask them, you know, or write it down, talk to your neighbor. What stops you from being fully committed to Christ or living full on for God? I mean, how does that go?
Yeah, that's exactly how we'll ask them to really reflect on the week. They will have been reflecting already. What are the actual barriers that are there? Are those intellectual barriers? Are they emotional barriers? Are they sin barriers? We want to invite the students to really consider, to go beneath the surface. Again, in light of everything that we've been talking about, if their ultimate design, which I think it is, to worship God, that's all of creation's ultimate design, then they are not fulfilled. They're never going to be completely satisfied unless they are living out that design. So we want to invite them to do exactly that, to move into their design and to figure out what barriers are actually there.
That's awesome. And it's easier for us that are a little older to say, hey, there's an emptiness in the world, in the sin of the world. Unfortunately, some people have to experience that for themselves, as we know, but at least you can lead the horse to water. You can't make him drink. Yeah. So are there any questions you'd hoping I was going to ask you during this interview, or something you'd like to just, you know, usually we address this, or anything that, you know, I don't know.
I don't know about any particular questions. I thought maybe you would ask me if I knew how to pronounce some of the New Zealand words. And I was scared about it.
It's a learning experience.
We've heard that you've lived in New Zealand for 20 years or so.
Yeah, 20 years.
And I don't detect a beautiful New Zealand accent.
No, I was 40 when I came here. I was a teacher in Southern California for 10 years, high school science teacher, and God called us here. We were with a university campus evangelism ministry, and God has since just shifted us to doing lots of different things, mostly towards youth and young adults, towards that audience, and with an apologetics bent towards it. And so, yeah, we never would have guessed. You know, God never shows us the whole picture, does he? Understanding God's will for your life. He's going to give you this much because it'll freak you out if he tells you the whole thing. Right.
It's usually in retrospect, looking backwards where you see it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, exactly.
That's true. I will come wearing my greenstone that was gifted the last time I was there.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Now, no, you kind of, I've been here for, you know, 22 years now. And so there's still some Kiwi-isms and sayings and words. And I'm like, what was that? And like,
sure.
You'll say college here a lot of times means high school.
High school. Yeah.
So I usually just say university now, to catch myself, but there'll be a lot of things. And, I'm excited for you guys to come and just catch a little bit of Kiwiana, you know, tour the country and see the beautiful country and impart to the young people of this nation. It's going to be a good time.
We're very excited
to be there. I can't wait to meet the students that God's bringing to Thinking Matters Camp. I can't wait to get to know them. Maybe catch a bit of the accent. I want some of it. we'll see what happens.
It's hard to catch up with that. Well, so I'll ask you something that I ask all my guests as we leave out, and that's what waters your soul the most as a Christian? You can each individually answer this. I mean, sometimes people say, well, my walk with God has gotten stale or lifeless or routinized. So what kind of personal spiritual disciplines or habits are of the greatest impact of your faith, keeping things alive?
Two things come to mind for me. One is quiet. Especially quiet in nature. The way I normally partake in that is, maybe there is a bit of noise because it's riding my dirt bike.
The quiet is in my dirt bike.
When I say quiet, I think of people not talking.
Or like entertainment, not.
Yeah, that's right. No words being spoken, no music, just maybe the rev of an engine and the Colorado mountains where I live, man, that keeps me in a worshipful attitude. The second thing that comes to mind is teaching. Actually, I love teaching because I love preparing to teach. When I'm studying God's word and seeing those truths that were always there right in front of me come to life excites me. And then the fact that I get to share it, That's worship for me. It excites me to no end.
That's cool. I've never heard it explained that way. I think that's kind of me. I mean, I do these talks that you're doing, and there's going to be a camp with Nick Blackie down in Christchurch in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to do a new talk on just the prophecies, the prophecy of Tyre, you know, the city of Tyre, and then the Messianic Isaiah 53. And I'm excited about that. It just, wow, Jesus really is the Messiah. The Bible really is true.
Yes.
It's a rejuvenator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Megan?
Well, I would say both of those things. I like quiet. I like nature. But I think the thing that probably feeds my soul is glimpses of things that are beautiful. Beauty aesthetics is an area that I started studying a few years ago, and it has just been the most wonderful thing. I told you that the thing that drew me to apologetics was learning that the truth was very beautiful. And those three transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty, I don't know that you can really get to the end of one without pouring over into the other, although they are distinct things. But beauty has a lot of mystery involved with it. And the more that I study it, the more I understand it's because questions about beauty are wrapped up in us as image bearers. So it's one of those things that I think is objectively real, finds its home in God, but it's something that we can spend our whole lives studying and leaning into and we'll never fully exhaust learning about it. So there's more beauty to behold literally forever. So anytime I find glimpses of beauty, whether it's visually or other sensed qualities, I think those are big windows into opportunities to worship the Lord. And even in the cultivation of beauty, which both beholding beauty and making beautiful things or cultivating beauty in the world, they both require work on our part. They don't come naturally. They require a certain kind of inefficiency, and the world is not really good at inefficiency. We are pretty obsessed with productivity and being efficient all the time. And so I think that those are restful moments. And so beauty is one answer. The other is I love words. I love words both in studying the original language. I'm not a Hebrew or Greek scholar, but when I glean things about what certain words mean or unpack certain passages, it's like these little treasures that you get to unearth that give more understanding to the word. So the word, yeah. So those are my probably two of the things I'd name. I'm sure there are many. Coffee might be another. Coffee brings life to me.
My wife would give a big amen to that.
I'm really excited about the coffee in New Zealand.
Oh, they've got some good coffee. And I my wife tends to think maybe it's because we have such good dairy here. You know, if you put dairy in the coffee, I don't know. My wife is a coffee snob. She questions if I'm even saved because I don't drink coffee.
I don't drink coffee either.
Oh, there you go.
I think your wife we would be good friends.
Right. Well, Tripp and Megan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today and just sharing with, you know, parts of your lives and what you're going to share at the camp. And our nation's in for a huge blessing when you get here. Where do people go if they want to, you know, hear some of your messages or sermons or talks or whatever? You have websites, or where would you refer us to?
Yeah, the easiest place to go is str.org, and you can find things. We're pretty new to STR, but you can find lots of information on our, you know, from our colleagues. But then
that's STR as in stand to reason. Yeah. Okay.
That's right.
Stand to reason, str.org. But then also if you were to just search either of our names, in YouTube or Google, then you'll be able to find some things from us that way too.
There's a lot of years going back. So who knows what you'll unearth. I hope not.
Yeah. I hope not.
All right. Well, for those of you that are out there, thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to the Thinking Matters podcast so you can be tuned in to the future podcasts. We'll have interesting guests like Tripp and Megan. Thanks for listening. Tune in next time. God bless.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.